Lectionary Lab Live is recorded by Two Bubbas and a Bible. We're glad that you're tuning in. Welcome, everybody, to the Lectionary Lab Live. I'm John Fairless. I'm here with my Bubba, Delmer Chilton. Say hey, Bubba.
Hey, Bubba. How you doing?
Man, I'm doing good, as always. It's nice to hear your voice, and we're going to get together here and talk a little text today. We're ready for the fifth Sunday after Pentecost, proper seven, and last week we talked about the many different ways you could name this Sunday. We won't go back into that. But we're going to talk a little more Ahab, Jezebel, and Elijah. And so for our main gospel text this week, of course, we're continuing in Gospel of Luke. And we got demons and Jesus on the move. What are you thinking about in terms of preaching this week, Bubba?
Well, every time I run up on this text, I cannot help but think about movies that were so popular about the time I was in college in the 70s, like The Exorcist and Rosemary's Baby and all of those kind of things. So these always come to mind when this text comes along. And part of that has to do with we moderns have a difficult time figuring out what to do with this kind of language. I mean, some of us are okay with demon possession and exorcism, and I'm not going to assume that you're not, but I think the general culture, this is in the realm of fantasy and horror movies, not the realm of their religious experience. So one of the questions you have to ask yourself as you get into this text is, how much do you need to say about that to your congregation about, you know, belief? Well, I remember when I was in seminary and when I was going to school to church in Chapel Hill, where the University of North Carolina is, I remember several times on this text, both teachers and preachers, sort of segueing into issues of mental illness as a way to talk about this. And, I think there was probably some mental illness that was identified as demon possession, but not all. I think we just need to respect what this text says and not get overly energetic in creating modern interpretations that make it easier for us to live with. I guess I'm saying we need to live with the strangeness of the text.
Sure. Don't try to over justify it, over explain it, or think you have to understand it in order to understand the setting in order to get the message.
Take it the way in which Luke presents it so that you can hear the theological message. Don't get too eager to demythologize. Live with the mythology a while. Maybe that's the way to put it. I'm not saying it's false. I'm just saying live with the story as it is on the page.
Right.
So what you've got here is they're over in a Gentile country, and there are swine herders. It's down south of Galilee, about 30-some miles. And Luke is foreshadowing, as Luke likes to do. He likes to write in parallels. So he's got Luke Acts. So right here, he is foreshadowing Christian missionaries in the book of Acts going into Gentile territory and meeting up with evil spirits and other gods, and how do you deal with that? So this kind of, these parallels just play out all the time. So in the story, every time that Luke has an exorcism, it follows a particular pattern. And so you can see this pattern come out in the story. First of all, you have this confrontation. The person who has the demon confronts the person of God. In Acts, it will be the missionaries, Paul and Peter and others that confront. And here it's Jesus. And instead of saying, come up, help me, the demons through the person are saying, get away from me, leave me. There's a confrontation. And there's an identification by name. And down in 8:30, what is your name? Names itself Legion for many demons. And then there's an ID of the demon, the command of the demon to leave, you know, come out of him. Now, what's one of the things interesting, the health of the person, and then to talk about the health of the person, freed of the demons is the next step after the command of leaving. And then you address the reaction of the bystanders. This pattern happens over and over.
Right.
there's an interesting few lines in here to play around with. One is 8:31. They begged him not to order them to go back into the abyss. What is the abyss?
Mm-hmm.
The abyss is the nether world.
Right.
And it is the place of the dead. In later New Testament, it's the prison, like Peter talks about, the spirits in prison, 1 Peter 3:19. Or over in Revelation, it's Satan's prison, Revelation 23. Mm-hmm. So the demons are saying, we're out and around in the world, and if we get cast out, we have to go back.
Mm-hmm.
We like being out here in the world. Please, you know, it's not a don't send me into the briar patch. It's an interesting thing of don't send us back into Satan's abyss. So perhaps they thought being in the swine and going, therefore, and they led them into the sea, would get them away from the power of Jesus Christ. These are, they're trying to avoid the powers, both the power of Satan and the power of Jesus. An interesting kind of dynamic going on. And the message that Luke wants to come across is there is no place that you can get away from the power of Jesus.
Mm.
There's no place Jesus' power can't go.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you get down
including,
to
including, by the way, the abyss,
yes,
as well as the herd of swine.
Well, that's the first Peter, you know, he went to preach
right.
the spirits in prison. Mm-hmm. That's the first Peter thing. There's nowhere you can go, even hell, where you can ultimately get away from God's power. So you come down to 34 through 37, and you've got the reaction of the bystanders, which is the important part of the story, ultimately, you know, is what's going on here. You've got a typical exorcism. Don't throw us in the briar patch and all this kind of stuff. And he sends them out and he heals them. The important part of this story comes down 34 through 37, where the people ask Jesus to leave.
Mm-hmm.
In the parallel in Acts 16, same thing happens to Paul. When he heals, then they want him gone. They put him in jail. Remember we talked about it, we preached back in Acts, back in Easter season, this whole thing where they ended up in jail, a parallel story. Why? Fear of and loss.
Mm-hmm.
Fear and economic loss. Fear of a power that cannot be controlled. The powers that be do not like powers they cannot have under their thumb. And economic loss. I think it's really interesting in this story, you know, the swine herders are pretty upset. They lost their animals, you know?
Yeah.
And in the Acts story, the people who had the young woman who had the demon, they lost their income from her doing her witnessing, her seeing, her translation.
Well, I was just going to say, I think it's a good point when we did that story in Acts a few weeks ago, you made a valid point. This is not a religious reaction per se.
No,
this is not, this is economics. This is, you know, hitting people where it hurts and, not to be considered too lightly. There's always a connection here between power and money, the power and the marketplace. We literally saw the rulers, the political leaders. In the marketplace, in the story in Acts, and here you get all of the people coming in, and after they've heard the story, and great fear, and man, you got to move on. I just got to say, I've heard people, and I've probably thought it and said it myself over the years, say, "Oh, wouldn't it have been wonderful to be there for the ministry of Jesus? We would have just, you know, to see something like this, to see that man in his right mind and sitting fully clothed, and as if we would react any differently." I mean, they were scared less,
you know, they were.
And we more than likely would be too. And I don't want to pass over that. I'm not sure I want to make that the point of this sermon, but as a pastor trying to get into this, I want to at least ask the question, why was everybody so scared when they saw this? And, you know, what do I need to pay attention to
here? Well, and they're afraid because here's a power that I don't know how to control and nobody else is controlling, and it's upset the apple cart, and we do not like things to change.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, the presence of God changes our relationship with money. if we, it should change our relationship with money, both the way we're willing to get money and the way in which we spend money and what we do with it. And most people don't like to know that and don't like to think about that. And so what they do is they accuse us preachers of telling them that so that we'll get more of their money.
Their money. And therein lies the rub. Whenever I think it's my money, it's my life, it's my world, I'm in control. No.
as one person put it, people did not praise Jesus for healing.
Mm.
People counted the cost of health and found it to be too much.
Yeah.
People do not like the cost that comes with the healing. To go with Jesus or stay where you're needed, he talks to that the person healed. He said, "Oh, I want to go with you."
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Go back home. Stay here. I wants to go with Jesus, but Jesus stay where you're needed and tell people." How many of us feel ourselves torn between contemplation and action, of wanting to be with Jesus, of reading the text and praying and being in church with like-minded folks? And Jesus said, "No, you need to get out there. This is next few weeks in the Gospels. They're missional texts, and we need to be about the mission, which is not always comfortable." And he tells him, "No, you need to stay here." What's really fascinating to me is he says, "Tell them what God has done." You notice that?
Yeah.
He said, "Tell them what God has done for you." And so the man went away proclaiming throughout the city how much Jesus had done for him. Just like we talked about last week, every time you have one of these stories in Luke, it ends up with the Christological. Who is Jesus? And in this one, he says, "Tell them what God has done." And without comment, it says, "So the man went around telling them about Jesus."
Yeah.
Luke, what God has
slotted
done
in there.
Brought
yeah.
Jesus into my life.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, we have other texts today, continuing to read our way through Galatians. Maybe it doesn't. This is not one of those weeks where it necessarily happens to sync up. all that well, but it's still an important statement about what it means for us to be in Christ and particularly baptized into Christ. One might argue that we had a baptism of sorts here in the gospel story.
Yeah.
And this is a new life for this gentleman, and he's having to learn to live it. And we are baptized.
The fact that he's in the Gentile territory.
Mm-hmm.
Gentiles, a lot of Gentiles he's dealing with is a foreshadowing of the mission going out into the Jewish, into the
right,
extended beyond Judaism into the Gentile world. They're all children of God. This is the way the Jew and the Greek and the slave and the free, no longer male. So that's an important text that, it'd be hard to avoid talking about in these days when we're struggling with some of that.
Yeah.
There's one quick thing in 3:24 about the disciplinarian until Christ came.
Right.
That's an unfortunate translation.
Yeah.
The word there it refers to a particular person in a Greek household who was a guardian, a caretaker, a tutor, a male, whatever a male governess would be, who was responsible for the child, taking them to school, bringing them home from a kind of upper class understanding, you know. And it says, "You were all children of God through faith, but you're no longer subject to a disciplinarian now that you've grown up at a certain point." So it's an image of the law as kind of teaching us so that we're prepared to receive faith.
Yeah. Yeah.
Strict disciplinarian, hard nosed, follow all the rules. It's a different understanding of that.
Yeah. We struggle in English with, disciplinarian. Sometimes we hear translated the law as our schoolmaster. None of those words really quite get out.
I want a Swedish au pair. That's what I think. I'm a boy. That would work for me.
Oh, there you go. Well, in terms of our parallel text or semi-continuous text today, we're continuing in the cycle with Elijah. We sort of move back to where we started this cycle to what happens right after what we called the God contest on Mount Carmel. And Elijah achieves, by all measures, great success that day. God answers the prayers. It's very dramatic. There's just no doubt that the power of God was revealed through the ministry of Elijah. Well, then you get this whole thing of, you know, what comes next after a great victory? I can remember as a young pastor hearing the older, more experienced pastors say, watch out. That's one of the most dangerous times in the life of faith. That's a dangerous time in the life of leaders. Right after things go great and things are going good, be careful. And so Elijah, for whatever reason, Jezebel is setting her sights on him. I'm going to make your life like the one of these prophets who just got slaughtered because of what you did. So she is, and of course she's the queen. She's got the power of the state behind her. I'm going to get you. And Elijah is afraid. Yeah, so afraid, he gets up and he runs. He flees for his life, and he takes off, kind of runs and until he just drops. All right, he runs for a whole day. He's into the wilderness. He sits down under the tree, and he said, "I've had enough. Lord, I'd just soon die. I don't want to keep going." So, first of all, I think we've got an opportunity to reflect here. Our people in the pews understand situations like this. Everything's going great, and then all of a sudden it takes a turn. And we probably pretty much any week and every week have people sitting out there going, "Hey, you know, I'm kind of at the end of my rope. I think I've about had enough. I'm just tired of the way my life is going." As pastors, as leaders, I think we have to admit we go through those times of struggle in our ministry, in our lives, in our families. So it's an opportunity.
Oh, no, God, my life is an idyllic existence. Ever since the Lord hands were laid on me and I received the Holy Spirit, everything has just been fine. Thank you very much.
You too can receive the ordination at the hands of Brother Delmer, 1995, and we'll give you an anointed prayer cloth.
There you go. That's right.
Anyhow.
Someone told me that.
Yeah.
One pastor reminded me when I was a young man. Young pastor, he said, "You know, be gentle. You have no idea what pain sits in those pews. Everybody, some of them just holding on."
That's it. Well, I think we have an opportunity to sit with Elijah under the broom tree here. And maybe that's a direction to take for this text on this day. Invite people, say, "You know, it's okay if you just need to stop and sit under the tree here." And Elijah's tired and he's worn out and he falls asleep. Then we start this series of what I have called in our commentary sort of therapy from God in the truest sense, healing. Okay, how does the healing begin? It starts with the physical. The angel says, "Get up and eat." And there's this miraculous provision of these cakes baked on hot stones. Kind of reminds me of back in the Easter season, the seashore breakfast where Jesus invites them to come out of the boat, and there he's already got fish and bread cooking on the fire.
Right.
You know, there it is. So he eats and he drinks and he lays down again. He doesn't have God saying, "Elijah, I'm ashamed of you. Get up, son. We got to get going." There's a time to rest and get healed. And not only one session of it here, two sessions of it for Elijah. And then the second time, will come, get up and eat, take strength, or else this journey will be too much for you. There's a word from the Lord here. Yeah, it is hard. I understand that. Then once he's gained strength, it's time for him to go to Horeb, to the mountain of God. And we get the relatively famous story of Elijah in the cave and go out and stand before the Lord. And we get the wind, like a hurricane force wind. We get the earthquake, we get fire, all of these pyrotechnics, and the repeated phrase, "But the Lord was not in the wind. The Lord was not in the earthquake. The Lord was not in the fire." And then comes my favorite, and I do love the translation of the NRSV here. "And then there was the sound of sheer silence."
I wonder how much that was influenced by Simon and Garfunkel.
I don't know. I don't know. But to think of silence as something tangible.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's where we find the presence of God. with the key question, what are you doing here, Elijah? Oh, man, do not go over that question too quickly. Not only what are you doing here in this cave, what are you doing here at this point, you know, in your ministry? What, you know, what are you doing here? What is your life, Elijah? Yeah. What is your call to ministry, if you will? And Elijah, you know, he's always a little willing to take advantage to complain when he can. And, you know, well, I'm the only one left, God. They're after me, and now they're going to kill me. And, you know, and in our text for today, it ends with God saying, go on now and return. I want you, you've been strengthened. I want you to go and continue this ministry. We don't read the portion of the text that says, I still have 7,000 in Israel who have not bowed the knee to Baal. So there's always more to it than we can see. God allows him to get strengthened. A significant portion of that is the opportunity to sit in the sheer silence. And then God with us. Go on, Elijah. It's okay. I'm going to sustain you. So I don't know which direction you end up. I don't know that you could cover all of that in a sermon on this text, but it's a rich opportunity.
I think you, if you could, I was thinking about it homiletically, if you can tell the quickly
right.
the story of conflict mm-hmm. and that he's scared, he's had a great victory in life. Mm-hmm. Then this whole thing, the Abraham Maslow hierarchy of need,
right?
You know, of what he needed and how he was cared for. And taken care of. That's a wonderful, you know, he gave him food. He gave him a safer place to sleep than under a broom tree, you know, and in the cave and all of that. And then the whole question of how do you know the presence of God in the world? You know, and I've never seen anybody do it, but I think you could do a thing with Martin Luther's kind of theology of glory versus theology of the cross. I mean, this, the lightning, the noise, the pyrotechnics. You know, and God's not there. God's in that sheer silence. And just thinking about how many times we think, I haven't heard from God. Well, maybe. That's
you need to slow down. Yeah.
Slow down and listen. And listening to yourself and to God in the midst of that. I mean, that's just all very powerful stuff that perhaps we're moving too fast and talking too much to hear from God.
Well, and I want to say a quick word, and we got to wrap up, Bubba. I am not opening the worship wars discussion here. But sometimes we feel like we need to do more in worship. We need to have more excitement. We need to have, you know, music with a beat. We need the praise band. We need, you know, strong hymn, whatever. Okay. We tend to want to make things more crowded, more busy in order to make them more attractive. And this is a great opportunity to dig into a text that, number one, started by just waiting under the tree and ends in a cave and in sheer silence. It's not the pyrotechnics. It's not all the excitement. It is just the simple presence of God. And are we called in some ways to?
I remember when college for an interview, Guilford College, knocked on what I thought was the right door and had a little card with my appointment, you know. I knocked on the door, said, come in. I stepped in. The man looked up at it and said, what are you doing here? I have an appointment for an entrance interview. Yeah, well, what are you doing
here? What are you doing
here? My name's Delmer Chilton. I have an appointment. He said, I know that, but what are you doing here? I'm here for my appointment. He said, not in this room, in this light. What are you doing here?
Dumbass. Can't you figure it out?
I don't know how good he was at admissions, but he sure was good at asking important questions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, Bubba, good stuff today. As always, I'll look forward to getting back with you next week. But for today, not much left for us to do other than tell everybody bye.
Everybody bye.
All you gotta do is look for the bare necessities.
Lectionary Lab Live is a Two Bubbas and a Bible production. Our opening theme is Crawdad Stomp by Joshua Kirsch. We go out this session with The Bare Necessities from the Walt Disney movie The Jungle Book, written by Terry Gilkison, featuring the voice talents of the great Phil Harris, Sebastian Cabot, and Bruce Reitherman.
Off my big home, the bees are buzzing in the tree to make some honey just for me.
When you look under the rocks and plants and take a glance at the fancy ants, then maybe try a few.
You eat ants?
You better believe it. And you're going to love the way they tickle.
Mowgli, look out!
The bare necessities of life will come to you.
Look where?
They'll come to you. Look for the bare necessities, the simple bare necessities. Forget about your worries and your strife. I mean the bare necessities. That's why a bear can rest at ease with just the bare necessities of life. Now when you pick a pawpaw or a prickly pear,
ow!
And you prick a raw paw, well next time beware. Don't pick the prickly pear by the paw. When you pick a pear, try to use the claw. But you don't need to use the claw when you pick a pear of the big pawpaw. Have I given you a clue?
Golly, thanks, Blue.
Pawpaw. Of all the silly gibberish.
Come on, Baggy, get with the beat. The bare necessities of life will come to you.
They'll come to me.
They'll come to you. How about scratching that old left shoulder while you're up there, Mowgli? No, just a hair lower. There, right there, that's it. Oh, this is beautiful. That's good. Kid, we've got to get to a tree. This calls for some big scratching.
You're lots of fun, Blue.
Right on it. Yeah. That's delicious. Oh, just a little bit. Oh, man, this is really living. So just try and relax. Yeah. Cool it. Fall apart in my backyard. Because let me tell you something, little Bridges. If you act like that bee acts, you're working too hard. And don't spend your time looking around for something you want that can't be found. When you find out you can live without it and go along not thinking about it, I'll tell you something true. The bare necessities of life will come to you.
I give up. Well, I hope his luck holds out.
Mowgli, how about you, Sam?
Look for the bare necessities, the simple bare necessities. Forget about your worries and your strife.
Yeah, man.
I mean the bare necessities. That's why a bear can rest at ease with just the bare necessities of life. Yeah, with just the bare necessities of life.
Yeah, man.